Have you ever looked at a stranger and wondered, what's their story? I'm Leah Tao, one of the creators of The Moth, bringing you KCRW's new storytelling program, Strangers. Listen now at kcrw.com/strangers or wherever you download podcasts.
From KCRW Santa Monica and kcrw.com, this is The Treatment.
Welcome to The Treatment, which you can also hear at kcrw.com. My guest, writer-director Bob Whitey, has a taste for comedy, well, that runs towards the absurd. He's made documentaries on Mort Saul and Lenny Bruce, his film on W.C. Fields won an Emmy. He worked with Larry David for years on Curb Your Enthusiasm, and his newest film on Woody Allen is simply called Woody Allen, a Documentary. It ran on American Masters. It's now available on home video. Bob, thanks so much for being here.
It's a pleasure to be here, Elvis.
Tell me, though, I mean, because some of these people you've been interested in, going to the Marx Brothers as well, are these people who have this kind of interest in commenting on the absurd or creating absurdity around them? Where does that come from for you?
I always loved comedy. As a kid, I loved stand-up comedy. I'd watch comics on the Ed Sullivan Show, and I'd stay up late and watch comics on The Tonight Show. And I love film comedy. I love film comedians. In junior high school, I discovered the Marx Brothers, and I think I can literally say it changed my life and sort of gave me a direction. And then from that group, I mean, the earliest obsessions were with early comedy, the Marx Brothers and Laurel and Hardy. And I discovered The Silence when I was in high school, you know, Keaton and Chaplin and all of that. And I loved Woody Allen. Take the Money and Run came out when I was 9 or 10 years old. That was his first feature as a writer and director, and I loved it. So I just kept watching all of his films as they came out. So these are all the people I've always loved, and most of those obsessions were comedic. And my films have all really been sort of, I don't know, very public thank you letters to all of them for the joy they've brought me, and it's my way of sharing that with the rest of the world.
But even with your interest in Kurt Vonnegut as well, again, this sort of commenting on absurdity is a fascinating thing to sort of to look at in terms of the way you've approached and pursued these people.
Yeah, all these guys and Lenny Bruce, I mean, their view of the world helped shape my view of the world. And what I loved about certainly, I guess, the link between Lenny and Vonnegut was that they just made the absurdities of life very palatable. And by making it humorous, you could digest it. It didn't mean you'd go out and do anything to change the world, but it definitely affected my view of the world. And I just love the comedic approach that they both brought to these social, political, world, and personal issues.
Yeah, you can almost say Vonnegut wrote as kind of a stand-up. I mean, his characters are always commenting on what was going on around that.
And it's interesting, too, because I think what Kurt liked about my take on him, which, you know, a lot of people just take him very seriously, almost like a guru. But Kurt always thought of himself as a humorist first, and that was our connection. And I came to him and approached him in that context. And, boy, when I first wrote to him in 1982, I had just finished my first film on the Marx Brothers, and I wrote to him saying, you don't know who I am, but I just made this documentary on the Marx Brothers because I'm a big fan of theirs, and I'd like to make a documentary on you because I'm a big fan of yours, and maybe we could talk about it. But he wrote me right away, and he told me that he had seen my Marx Brothers film, and he loved it, and I was welcome to call him and talk to him. And when we got together, I discovered right away that the thing that we could talk about was comedy. So the first time we spoke on the phone and the first time we met in person, we were talking about the Marx Brothers and Laurel and Hardy and W.C. Fields. And, you know, he grew up, you know, going to those movies and hearing great comedians over the radio, you know, Jack Benny and Ed Wynn. And that's what shaped his outlook, too.
Talking about comedy, seriously, with Robert Whitey, his last film is Woody Allen, a documentary, ran on the American Masters. It's now on home video. It's The Treatment, by the way, which you can catch at kcrw.com also. There's also this kind of interest, too, in comedians who are compulsively verbal almost exhibitionistic in their verbal skills, from the Marx Brothers to Vonnegut to Saul and Woody Allen to basically Larry David. I mean, this has been this thing, too, that seems to attract you as well.
Everybody that I talk to, all artists of this sort of caliber, at least that I've gotten to know, you know, the Mort Saul and I remain friendly, Woody Allen, Kurt Vonnegut, you know, they always talk about how they just do what they do and they don't think that much about it. And then, you know, sometimes very smart academics or critics will sort of point out running themes in their work and they'll look at it and go, oh, yeah, that's interesting. I guess I do that, you know, without thinking that much about it. And it's funny to hear that done with me because my work has been mainly showing off the work of others that I admire so much. So I haven't really thought too much about what the connecting link is between all those people. But you may be on to something. I don't know.
But talk about what the whole Woody Allen documentary process, how that started, how you got approvals from him, and how long it took to make.
Well, like I say, Woody, you know, with, say, the Marx Brothers, their work was behind them by the time I discovered them in junior high school, as was W.C. Fields. They were all long gone. The joy
and probably, by the way, most of the people you've done have been influenced by the Marx Brothers.
Yeah, well, it all comes back to that, doesn't it? Yeah, well, they were so unique. They were, you know, those characters are iconic now. You think about Groucho, you just physically picture them, or you think about what they did, and it's so iconic. But somebody had to come up with those characters. I mean, somebody had to say, maybe it'd be funny if I smudged some grease paint under my nose and darkened my eyebrows. And I mean, who would just think of that out of the blue? It's very interesting to me. But yes, certainly Woody was a big Marx Brothers nut. That was one of the things that helped get his authorization, was he was familiar with my work, my past documentary work, which he watched only because he and I both have the same obsessions. So, you know, he knew my work. I knew him a little bit over the years because I actually had an early job with his producers slash managers, Rollins and Joffe.
That was your introduction to the business, basically, wasn't it?
Yeah, my first job was actually as a gopher. I was bringing back lunch and getting their cars washed. I remember I was making $127 a week after taxes, and I was happy as a clam. I thought I was in the heart of show business. But because I'd always loved Woody Allen, the idea of working for his managers, whom I knew historically so well, was very exciting. But in any event, so I knew Woody a little bit through – later I started to work with them in a development capacity. But I knew Woody a little bit because I'd go out to New York and work out of the office there. I'd see him in the hallway, and of course he was in my Marx Brothers film. But a very kind of cursory acquaintanceship. We'd see each other at screenings and have a little chat. But I had asked him over the past 25 years or so about making a documentary on him, and he'd always very politely – turned me down. It was never a question of control or anything like that. It was – he really has the self-deprecating streak where it was like, who am I? Who am I to have a documentary made on me? I'm no big deal, you know. He couldn't understand why I'd want to do it, who would finance it, who would put it on the air, or who would watch it. And this is not an act. This is not false modesty. This is really how he thinks of himself and his work. So, you know, I remember in sort of the – of course, I started very young. I was 22 when I did my first film. So the advantage of starting that young is if you're trying to approach somebody for permission to do something and they tell you no, you just like wait a decade and then come back again. And if they say no, you can wait another decade. I figure, you know, I'm running out of decades here, and God knows, you know, he'll probably live to be 120. But I remember approaching him sometime in the 90s, early 90s about this. And his response, again, very polite, was he says, I still feel I'm, you know, midway through my career and not ready for any kind of retrospectives. So, again, I waited another decade. And this time, you know, it was October of 2008. I just wrote him a letter. I put it all in the letter. I made two cases. A, why this should be done now, and B, why I was the guy to make it. And my feeling was that if he said anything other than no, get out of here. In other words, if he left the door ajar slightly, I would push it open. So I made the case in the letter, and I got a call back from his assistant a couple of days later saying, well, Woody wants to know if he were to do this. And as soon as I heard the if, I thought, I'm in. And his questions were all very practical. Again, it was, how many days would I need him for? Would I want to shoot interviews with him? What else would I need? Would I want to come onto the set? It was all those kinds of questions, nothing about control or anything like that. And, you know, we worked out a, you know, basic agreement. And as soon as he gave me even a provisional yes, the first thing I did was I flew out to New York to interview Jack Rollins, his longtime manager, producer, who now was 95 or 96. I thought, better get that one in the can right away. And Jack, thankfully, is still with us. He's like 98 now, I guess. And started from there. and then went to London with him, with Woody, when he was shooting You Will Meet a Tall, Dark Stranger, and got to film him on the set, which was really a treat.
The persistent man I'm talking to is Robert Wiley. He's the director of the documentary Woody Allen, a Documentary. It's on home video now. It's The Treatment, which you can hear at KCRW.com. And the thing I was saying to you before we got started, which always fascinates me about Woody Allen, is he's been so specific in creating this Woody Allen character that it's always slightly jarring to me to hear him talk and not hear any of those pauses or ticks or see him playing with his fingertips, those things that people come to do in the imitation of him, that he's pretty plain spoken and speaks in complete sentences.
Yeah, he's, you know, it's funny, although there is some crossover. You know those heightened consonants, like instead of height, he'll say height, that sort of thing. And there was actually a line in our film where he's talking about when he first met Diane Keaton for the play Played Again, Sam. There was some concern that she might be
too
taller than he was. So he says in the thing, you know, there's some concern about her height. And there's the pause before the T. And the mixer turned it down. I said, no, that's how he speaks. You know, don't do that. That's how Woody Allen talks. There's a little bit of crossover in the way he speaks, but he's not, you know, he's so not neurotic in many ways. In some ways he is, but he's, you know, everybody who works with him says on the set, he's, and I witnessed this myself, very calm. There's nothing, you know, nervous about his demeanor. He knows how to get what he wants. He takes a very minimalist approach with his actors. His basic thing is, hire the best actors for the job. They know what they're doing. If they need a little adjustment, he'll give it to them. If they have a question, he'll answer it. Otherwise, he leaves them alone. And he's just a very calm presence on the set. So there's nothing quirky or neurotic about him at all in that regard. Now, the areas where he is a little strange is, I remember being in his editing room. I was going to be filming with him later that day. I was going to film an interview with him. And before he left for lunch, he and I were chatting for about 5 minutes, just about, you know, whatever. And he left, and his assistant editor came up to me. Her jaw had dropped, and she said, he just spoke to you more in the last 5 minutes than he's spoken to me in 5 years. I thought, okay, that's weird. Because she works in the same room with him. Now, it's a large room, but never on a Monday to say, how was your weekend? Or you had a birthday, how was your party? To not speak to your assistant editor in the room for all that time. She was shocked that he was actually verbose and talking to me. So it's those moments where I go, yeah, I guess he is a little strange in some ways.
And that's the thing that really kind of comes across in the film as much as anything else, the kind of layers of insulation that he's managed to create around himself.
Yeah, and I think some of that is you know, fairly typical of anybody who's a celebrity to the degree that he is. And he is extremely shy. He truly is. I mean, Scarlett Johansson refers to him as cripplingly shy. But he is insulated to a degree. And, you know, he's got his close friends. He's got the people who are around him that he trusts. Not all of them show business people by any stretch. There are a lot of, you know, civilians who are part of that group. And I think he's just a very private, very shy guy. You know, when he was doing stand-up in the clubs, it was torture for him because, as Charlie Jaffe, his manager, says in the film, you know, he could barely talk to people, let alone get up and perform in front of them. So I think a lot of that isn't so much about his place in show business or as a celebrity so much as it is about things that go back to childhood, and the people who knew him as a kid talk about how shy he was. So I think that's a big part of it.
We'll take a break, Mike. This is Robert Wiley. His new film, as documentarian, is Woody Allen, a Documentary. It's The Treatment. There's more to come. Stay with us.
You're listening to The Treatment with Elvis Mitchell from the studios of KCRW Santa Monica.
I'm Jenny Radelet, producer of The Treatment. If you like this program, check out other podcasts from KCRW, including Bookworm, The Business, DNA, Unfictional, and Good Food. They're on iTunes or on KCRW's smartphone apps.
Welcome back to The Treatment, which you can also hear at KCRW.com. My guest is Robert Wiley, who's made films on a number of comedy icons who have changed the face of comedy in their own way, but sort of moved the bar that was left before them. His newest in that trajectory is Woody Allen, the film Woody Allen, a Documentary, which ran on the American Masters last year. It's interesting because his work ethic at two particular points, I think, of just after Stardust Memories and about the time of Manhattan Murder Mystery with the Sun Yi stuff, is kind of that he doesn't stop. Must have been fascinating to you, because that's what the insulation sort of comes into me, because he was managing to keep himself pointed and working at points that would have probably, to get back to Scarlett Johansson, crippled somebody else.
He says that he could, you know, he writes in his room. You've seen the documentary. He writes on a legal pad on his bed, and then he types it up on this antique typewriter he got when he was 15 years old.
Did you get letters from him on that typewriter?
I do have a few. Yeah, it's amazing with, you know, if he makes a mistake, because, you know, there's no correcting ribbon on it. He just X's it out. And so, yeah, very old school. So he writes in his room and he says, you know, the house could be on fire, and he would keep writing until finally the smoke, you know, got to him and he had to go out a window. I mean, nothing stops him. So, you know, in the middle of all that stuff 20 years ago with this very public, ugly split from Mia Farrow and the business with him, you know, having the relationship with Sunyi Previn, you know, that, listen, if I get one upsetting phone call in the morning, I just want to curl up in a fetal position for the rest of the day and do nothing. Woody, in the midst of that, with all the trips to the courthouse and the trials and the hearings and all that, just never stopped working. And Juliet Taylor, his casting director, says that, you know, he would be due in court at 12 o'clock, but he'd hold a casting session at 10 o'clock and just work up until it was time to go and then come back and do some editing or whatever. It just, nothing got in his way. It's strange, but that's, I guess, if you're going to make whatever it is now, 42 films in 42 years, it takes that kind of focus.
Everybody has such great anecdotes about him. Does he have an understanding of the way people talk about him?
When he finally saw the documentary, you know, right before I delivered it to PBS, his notes were interesting because there was nothing. First of all, everybody thought, well, how's he going to react? Because, you know, I do talk about the split with Mia and Sun Yi, and he's fine with that. He couldn't have cared less. The kinds of notes that he gave me were, he'd say, oh, God, that joke from my old stand-up act, I always hated that joke. I never understood why people laughed at it. Can't you swap that out for something else? But he'd always say, you don't have to. I'm not telling you have to do it. I just want you to know that. So it was very minor things like that. But the other thing he was concerned about, and again, this is not false modesty, I believe this really is Woody, is he said, I'm afraid you made me look too good. Because he says, you look at this film and, you know, you look at the best of these clips and you think, oh, this guy's brilliant. He says, people are going to go out and they're going to rent the DVDs and look at them and go, oh, that wasn't very good. And they're going to be very disappointed. And I made certain there were a few people, I think I only let one genius into the film. I think Mira Sorvino refers to him as this kind of genius writer. But everyone else, when they used the G word, I would cut it out because I knew, you know, Woody would just, he wouldn't be able to stand it. And that was like the only time there was a little Woody on my shoulder, you know, dictating what to do, was not to let people get too laudatory about him.
It's The Treatment. We're offering our laudatory comments about Woody Allen. I'm talking to the director of the film, Woody Allen, a documentary, Robert Wydie. You can also hear the show at KCRW.com. I guess the one thing that I find, and you must have found it to be incredibly fascinating too, just hearing his family talk about him.
Yeah, you mean the interview with his mother?
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Well, you know, that was something in the mid-80s, he had this idea. He was going to do a documentary called Mothers, and it was going to be an interview with his mother, Nettie Koningsberg of Brooklyn, of Midwood, and Mia Farrow's mother, who's Maureen O'Sullivan, the actress, now deceased. But in any event, I don't quite know what the idea was other than he would film the two. I mean, talk about oil and water. I think he just wanted to sort of intercut between the two of them.
They kind of made films about both. If you look at Oedipus Rex from New York Stories and Hannah and Her Sisters, there's kind of fictionalized versions
right,
of both of those.
Exactly, exactly. But anyway, he filmed the interviews with both Maureen O'Sullivan and his mother, abandoned the project. This was years before the split with Mia, so it had nothing to do with that. He just abandoned it. And I thought, well, somewhere there's a couple of hours of interview footage with his mother. And I asked Woody, do you know where it is? And he said, oh, God, I have no idea. It's been 25 years since I've seen it. And I don't. He says, if you can find it, you're welcome to use it. Well, in any event, I found it. I spoke to Woody's line producer, Helen Robin, and I said, is there any sort of storage facility where Woody keeps negative and old film? And she says, yeah, there's a place in New Jersey. And anyway, together we sort of got into the the indexes for the stuff in storage, and there was a box of several cans of 35 millimeter film labeled Mother. So I dug it out and used it. In any event, that's sort of a long backstory. But I mean, I put this stuff up. There's only a little snippet of it in the film, and there's a little bit extra on the bonus materials on the DVD. But you know, watching, I think it was close to 3 hours of footage of this interview with his mother. A lot of those questions about Woody, about where these things come from, I'm no psychologist, but you watch this footage with his mother and some things start to make sense.
In watching all the films, did you start to see things in them that you hadn't seen before when you're just watching them in the aggregate? Because you probably had to do that to get ready for it.
I did, yeah. What I found was kind of interesting was how much my early views of the films sort of stayed where they were. In other words, if I loved a film when it came out, I kind of loved it now looking at it. If I didn't care for a film when it came out, didn't really much care for it now. And then there are a lot of films that were sort of in between. The one film that really came up in my estimation is Bullets Over Broadway, which I always thought was a good film. But when I watched it again in preparation for the documentary, I came to believe it was among his best. And I remember writing him just because I wanted to tell him this, that I just watched Bullets Over Broadway again, and I don't know how I missed it before, but I really think it's a brilliant film. And he wrote back, our emails back and forth always are a bit insulting and sarcastic and teasing, and he wrote back and said basically, what kind of an idiot are you for not having recognized until now what a work of genius this is? You know? It's only the self-deprecating guy, once I said I didn't, you know, realize how good it was, took offense at that. But I just find it interesting when looking at his canon that there are those periods of time where people wanted to sort of count him out and say that he was played out. And listen, as big a Woody fan as I am, there are a number of his films that I really don't need to see again, and that, you know, I had to just get through watching them again for the documentary. But every time he goes through a stretch of maybe two or three films that are uninteresting and you say, okay, well, maybe it's over. I mean, look at those films before Match Point. I mean, everybody was saying, all right, you know, he's through. And then suddenly everybody liked Match Point. Then after Match Point, it was Scoop, which nobody liked, and Cassandra's Dream, which most people don't even know about. And then it was Vicky Cristina Barcelona. So, and then again, a couple films, and then Midnight in Paris. So, you know, he's 76 years old. He's been at this since 1969, a film a year. And he's the first one to say, as he says in the documentary, that he's working on the quantity theory, which is just keep making them. Every now and then, one of them will come out okay. And I think as an artist, if I could use that word, it would embarrass him, but he's not here. I think as an artist, I think you have the right to do that. Just keep churning them out. Some will hit and some will miss. And the fact that he has the opportunity to do that, I mean, that's a very enviable position to be in.
The diligent Woody Allen fan I'm talking to is Robert Wydee. His new film is Dr. Andy Filmmaker is Woody Allen, a documentary. It's on home video now. It premiered on American Masters last year. It's The Treatment. You can also hear the show at KCRW.com. It must have been fascinating to you because basically getting your start in a business and meeting Larry David very early on, and then Larry David ending up in a Woody Allen movie, and you're making a movie about Woody Allen. What kind of conversations did you guys have about
that? Yeah, it was sort
that?
Of this crashing of these two worlds. Well, actually, Larry had had very small parts in two earlier Woody Allen films, which people forget, but to actually star in it. And it was funny because Larry said when he got the script and they told him to look for the part of Boris, he thought it would be some small supporting role. And the first thing that was on the page was this four-page monologue by Boris, and then he went to page 20, Boris, page 40, Boris. And he thought, oh, my God, this is the lead role. And he was really nervous about doing it because Larry can't memorize dialogue. I mean, that's why Curb Your Enthusiasm is improvised. It has nothing to do with trying to break new ground, a different way of doing television. Larry can't memorize dialogue. So from the beginning, he says, well, just do an outline. It won't really be scripted.
Because your relationship with him goes back to the 80s when you got his first script, right?
Yeah, I've known Larry since, I guess it was 83 or so we became friends. And I used to go with him to the clubs when he was doing stand-up, both in L.A. and New York. And just the audience didn't know what to make of him. He would do his stuff, and there were nights when people would boo him or tell him to get off the stage, and then he would be combative and fight with them, and chaos would erupt. And then there's those legendary times he would just walk out on stage and kind of survey the audience and think, no, this is not going to go well, and say, never mind, and walk off. You know, but he had these very, these almost kind of, there's a almost a Robert Benchley-esque element to his work. These kind of, conceptual flights of fancy. I remember this, he would come out on stage, by the way, and, you know, no good evening or how are you or anything like that. He just, you know, like a deer in the headlights, and he would say, you know, every day I thank God that I wasn't born a wealthy Spanish landowner, which is already an odd premise for a comedy, but he'd say, because if I was, I would never know whether, in addressing the help, whether to use the to form or the usted form. He'd say, you know, I don't want to use the usted form and have them think I'm being patronizing, yet I don't want to use the to form and have them feel so familiar that they can just come into my kitchen and help themselves to anything in the refrigerator. Well, I would be hysterical, and a couple of comics in the back of the room would be hysterical, but the audience did not know what to make of him. And I thought, you know, if the country ever catches up to this guy's sense of humor, there'll be riots in the streets. And then one day, you know, and Larry could barely make a living. He was so uncommercial, and, you know, no one was going to hire him for anything. And then one day, Jerry Seinfeld
said, man who, by the way, quit Saturday Night Live and then walked back and slumped back into the offices.
Yes, and then used that as a George story for Seinfeld. But, yeah, Jerry came up to him one day and said, I've got this deal at NBC. They want a pilot script. You want to write it with me? And the rest of is history. But what's odd is for those of us who knew Larry when nobody knew him and nobody appreciated him, and he seemed like the least likely guy to write a television show, when that show became a number one hit, and by the way, without compromise, true to Larry David's vision, those of us who knew him all those years were just shaking our heads going, how did he do that? The guy who is the most incomprehensible guy to the masses is now having, you know, whatever, 15 million people tuning in every week to watch his work. It's quite incredible.
But I just imagine, given that you in those days are working with Woody's managers and Larry there with the script, at some point you guys must have had flights of fancy about working with Woody Allen or having some Woody Allen connections someday, did you not?
Yeah, well, it's interesting because, as you know, I was just like one degree of separation from Woody working with his people and always thought, I wish someday I could get in there and really get to hang out with him a little bit. And Larry, yeah, I mean, there, you know, anybody who grew up really loving Woody Allen's movies the way somebody like Larry or I did, for Larry to get the phone call saying, you know, be in my movie and then have it be a starring role was a kick for him. And he had the same experience that I did, which is, you know, you spend, you know, like I say, you log enough FaceTime with Woody and, you know, you start to just accept him as a fairly normal guy. And then every now and then something will come out of his mouth that's really hysterical, that really doubles you over with laughter. And you say, where did that come from? And then you have to remember, oh, yeah, that's right, he is Woody Allen. So that may happen from time to time. So that was a shared experience between Larry and I.
Bob, we're out of time. Thanks so much for doing this.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you, Aldous. I appreciate it.
My guest is Robert Wyde. His new film as filmmaker is Woody Allen, a documentary. It's available on home video now. Our recording engineer and mixer is J.C. Swark. The show is edited by associate producer Jenny Radelet. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.
Find past episodes of The Treatment at kcrw.com or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. Listen to The Treatment on demand on your smartphone with KCRW's apps. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.